Hello everybody, and welcome to the Batwell Podcast. I'm Jay Martin, and it's been a while. It's been quite a while, actually. I think the last episode we did, if I quickly check on my phone now, was in March the 27th, so that was our second anniversary. That was the last time we did it. So near on 2 months now, or a month, should I say. And a lot's changed, I think it's fair to say. But we've still got the great quality content and quality guests. So I've got a guest with me today, Ash Hudson. Tell me... How are you feeling today? Welcome.
Yeah, I'm feeling quite good. Weather's nice. That's how we like it.
Absolutely. And obviously, you know, in the studio, we tend to get a lot of sun, I think it's fair to say. So you're definitely wearing appropriate clothing with the shirt and stuff. Maybe not so much myself with my jumper. But we're going to be talking to Ash. Now, I came across Ash on Facebook, and I think it was Richard McRae, we've had on the podcast a few times, introduced me to you or briefly tagged you in a post that I'd done and said, you know, this is someone of interest that you might be, you know, might be worth actually podcasting with. And I thought about it and I thought, yeah, let's get it done. I'm ready to go back in the studio. We're back in the studio now. And what better place to start than with you, Ash? So you put up a post on Facebook that I found important, because I know a lot of people listening to the podcast may be struggling for motivation. It's a tough time at the moment. I don't think many people have lived through a time like this. The pandemic, obviously a war in the Eastern Europe, and obviously a cost of living crisis. But what you put on Facebook inspired me. All of that almost went out of my head. So tell me a little bit about you now and a little bit about your journey and your story.
Well, I'll take you all the way back to the beginning.
Take me all the way back.
I was born on a council estate in Chesterfield, Bolsover, and I had a bit of a rough upbringing, a life full of abuse, and then I was bullied all the way through school, and I had a really tough time, and I went to college, started a life in Nottingham, and all was going really well, and then I had troubles with my mental health. I don't know where it came from. It was just all of a sudden thing. I was in and out of hospital. I was on medication. I didn't know how to get through that.
Yeah.
And then I had jobs, as you do. I worked at a pawnbroker's. I took a real interest in jewellery and watches. And that's where I got my idea about my watch business that I've got now.
Yeah.
And it was all really good there, and then I had a bit of a breakdown there, and then I've sort of ended up being unemployable.
Yeah.
Which I know sounds a weird thing to say, but because of who I am and the things I've gone through, I've always struggled with authoritarian figures. So I've had to learn how to control the way that I behave. Which has been really difficult. I was talking about it earlier, it's about being able to control my reactions before I have them. So thinking about the things that I can control, things that I can't control, I level myself and think about what I can change and what's just got to happen. And if I can figure out what I can change, then I can get myself out of the situations that I'm in.
Of course. It's a sad story. It is a sad story, and I'm thankful that you've entrusted me and obviously the listeners into knowing that, because usually when it comes to people that I podcast with, I do tend to know them beforehand. Mm-hmm. When it comes to Richard, I know a lot about Richard beforehand. Didn't know everything, but I know a lot about him and obviously other people I've interviewed. But you're someone that I don't know in depth. I know you off Facebook, and I know that you're doing great, and I know everybody's very proud of you, and we're all looking forward to what the future has ahead. And I'm hoping that I save up some money so I can go and get myself a watch. I like my little watch, but I want a proper one, you know, and well, I'm sure we'll be able to talk about that later. But so, you know, a rough upbringing. And how has that made you want to go and do it? Has that, in a way, and I don't know how to word this, but kind of made you want to make a big change and, you know, try new things and do what you do now?
It almost sounds narcissistic, but I have this inner demon that has to prove to all the people that wronged me or all the people that bullied me at school how successful I am. And that is what drives me every day to get up in the morning and push myself. And one day for them to see on Facebook, like you said, you see me on Facebook, someone to see my face, say, "Oh, look how well Ash is doing," and that's pretty much what motivates me. And I know that sounds narcissistic, but that's what motivates me.
But there's, see, I know you. Yeah, you say it sounds narcissistic or whatever, but I don't think there's an issue with that. You know, I don't find an issue with that, because there's definitely people that in my life, not quite the same situation, but who have doubted me perhaps and have hated on me. And even people that I go to school with now in college, they've laughed at what I've done, and like my news page, and it's like, well, you know, we're past the 100 followers you said we wouldn't get past, so you know, you can keep laughing, that's okay. But there is always that, and I know people say, oh, I don't do it to prove anyone wrong, but I think they do. I think people say they don't, but in reality they do, because you know, we all have that instinct to go, that person has done something to me in the past and I'm not happy about it. I want to go back and show them what I really am, you know. So what's going on with the business at the moment? Because I know that you're doing really well, and it's only recently been, what's happened to it? It's something recently happened.
Well, it was the pandemic. So I think we spoke about it earlier. So people's buying habits have changed. So everyone suddenly started buying things online. No one was going to any shops, going nowhere. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to plug vintage watches online. And while I was furloughed, I've got nothing better to do. And it started, I had £100 to my name. So we'll go into that later, but I lost previous businesses. And this particular business only left me £100 in cash. So £100 in cash, I bought some watches, sold them, bought some more watches, sold them. And I got up to about £20,000 worth of watches, like, in total, through the lockdown. And then I just said, you know what, I'm leaving my job. And since then, it's, I amassed £100,000 worth of watches last year. And I brought my brother into the business. I wanted to bring my brother in. It's always been one of my goals, to look after my family. And then I scaled it to having now a jewellery and watch shop in the city centre as well, which is a separate business.
Wow. Wow, that is... You know, and this is things that I like to, you know, like to hear about. Because although we started the podcast with more of a sad kind of story, and, you know, we've already seen, I mean, even briefly from the 7 minutes that we've been doing this, this already journey to doing that. And I mean, to have £100 to your name, I mean, this is the idea of risk. And I like to talk about risk, and I'm going to ask you about risk now. What are your thoughts on taking risks? If someone was in a similar position to you, maybe not with watches, but they've got £100, £500, £1,000, whatever amount of money, and they think, okay, this is, I've got this, and I want to make a radical change to my life. Do you do it? Would you take the risk? What would you say?
Let me dig into my... Right, so I'll take you back. So I first met Louise, my partner. We've recently got married. When I met her, I was on medication for depression. I was self-harming. I was a mess. And when I met her, I made a radical change. And it was one of the best decisions that I made. So that's fantastic, isn't it? However, I've also made radical changes in my life because of my erratic behaviour, where it's cost me greatly. So I had an original business and I lost it. And that was because of my own behaviours that I weren't in control of. So what I would say about risk is it's about understanding the risk and analysing the risk before you make it. Because a lot of people, like myself, go into a decision headstrong and not think about the repercussions. And when you're gambling risk. But if you sit and analyse everything that you're doing, then that's circumventing any risk.
And it's about seeing value as well, isn't it, in the potential of something, you might argue.
You know? No, I think if you believe in something and you're passionate about it, then you can make it work. But it's understanding how you'll make it work. Who are your customers? Where are you going to sell it? Your unique selling point, all of these things. It might be great for you, but for someone else, it might be not of any interest.
So it's about knowing the... Obviously, if you're going to have a business that wants to make money, knowing your market, you know, you need to have a market. Otherwise, I could say, I'm going to sell old chewing gum wrappers. I've got loads of them. but I know realistically there's no market. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I say, I'm going to buy microphones, I'm going to twiddle with the engineering and make them into some super incredible things and spray them neon green, I say, well, there's probably a group of people that play Overwatch that might like this, you know, and stuff like that, and that'll be awesome. But obviously, I think taking risks is something that we do shy away from, I think, a lot of the time, because of the idea of people go, it's what-if-ism, isn't it? It's, well, what if I lose? You know, and obviously it's never easy to take a gamble or take a risk. But I suppose, as you said, there's a bit of a difference between the two in terms of you can analyse one and it becomes risky, or you can do the other and it's a gamble.
Yeah,
you're going in headstrong, no idea. It is just a pure gamble, you know. So obviously you've got your new business. How's that going for you? You know, is it, because it must be, you know, it must be tough even with COVID and whatever's going on now. Or how is that for you?
Yeah, so back on the risk side of things. So I worked at pawnbrokers, as I said, and people used to bring in bags of watches, and this pawnbroker would reject them and say, this is rubbish. And I looked online, I seen that these watches were worth money. So that was me figuring out that there was a market for that. So that's why that worked. And then the same with the jewellery, is that I was managing the shop that I'm at now and previously, and I seen that there was lots of dealers there that were selling the jewellery, and they all left during the pandemic. So for me, I seen that there was a unique opportunity. I know it sounds bad, but I was monopolising on other people's failure because they buckled during the pandemic. So I've moved into that space that they once were. So I knew that there wasn't a risk, because I knew that there was already a market there.
And it's just your job to use that market and basically get the most, and obviously increase your market share and just make sure that you are the top dog in that respect.
Well, that's it. Now, I could have gone in, so a risk again, I could have gone in with a small cabinet and had a bit of jewellery in it, but it wouldn't have had the impact that I wanted it to have, because now I've gone in there with such a large holding and such a large amount of space that anyone comes in that thinks they're going to want to do jewellery in the future, they're going to think, hold on a minute, there's this big kiosk here, what's the point in me competing with that? And that's why I made the decision that I've made to invest so heavily in it.
So I've got a question then in regards to, obviously, you say your shop is in the city centre, right? So competition. As a business, things go well, we're in a pub right now, and every business has competition, every single business. Some might argue social media doesn't, whatever, but that's just all in the cloud, isn't it? Right, we're talking physical things. You're in a city centre, there's hundreds of thousands of people in Nottingham, and perhaps the city centre is the most popular place to be.
Mm-hmm.
What is it like for you? Like, do you have much competition around the area, or...?
In business, it's about separating yourself from competition.
Mm.
So, as an example, you mentioned microphones. You could buy these microphones and you could sell them on Amazon at a premium. That's an easy business that anyone could copy. So if I'm buying broken watches that don't work, it takes a certain level of skills to be able to make them work and to be able to sell them. So you've already reduced your markets there. Plus, I'm also selling the lower end watches that people don't tend to go for. I call myself a bottom feeder, buy all the stuff people that don't want. And then that means that I'm my own standalone entity that no one can compete with. And because now I've got such volume, it'd take a stupid investment for them to ever be able to catch up.
So they, if they were to even try and catch up, it would take, I don't know, I'm just going to pull a number out of the air, 30, whatever, thousand or thousands of thousands, probably even more than that, if I'm being honest. So unless someone's going to pull more out of their arse and just go, here's all this money I want, you've still got to find all those watches somewhere.
Yeah.
You know.
And you've got to get the resources to be able to get them repaired. It'd be a logistical nightmare for anyone to copy my business.
Without it taking a couple, maybe a few years.
And a large, large investment.
So obviously throughout the pandemic, you said you did this. And you soon saw it developed into a passion. Is this a passion that you had before the pawnbrokers, or is this just something you just discovered whilst you were there?
I'm going to set the record straight, because I always say this to people. I don't have a passion for watches. I don't have a passion for jewellery. I have a passion for making money.
Mm. I know, I like that. I like that. And there's nothing, I think that's good. So in that case then, I can see that this probably won't be your last venture. I highly doubt it will be. And mm-hmm. I can see that I got some reaction there. So I do want to ask, is there anything that you've either dreamt about or that you've had a thought about? Maybe you've been sitting there and you've gone, when you've had time, obviously, and you've gone, I'd like to do that in the future. Is there things that you're interested in, and I'm not going to say passionate about, but is there things that you're interested in that maybe you'll venture into in the future?
I go wherever the money goes or wherever the opportunity is. That is what my answer would be. I do, however, have a passion, and that is breakdancing.
Yes.
And I do intend on doing some things within the community. That's my passion in the future. But business is not related to that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I see. No. So passion is more leisure, that kind of thing. Have you spoke to Richard McRae about the breakdancing thing? And is he, what's he? You
know, yeah, well, I had Beast and Breakers in Beeston for a while. And the pandemic happened. And then I got a diagnosis that I'd got arthritis in my neck. And then I couldn't figure out how to get myself back into it. And I feel like I'm ready. Because before, if I'd gone to a breaking jam, it's like going to KFC, but you can't eat chicken. It just makes no sense. So I've just been trying to get my head around the fact that I'm not going to be able to dance and how I can be involved in that community. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it's similar to people that I know that can't play football anymore because, you know, some of them are too old, for example, or have retired, but now they've gone into coaching and they say to me, it's just as rewarding, if not more rewarding, you know, to be able to bring on the next generation of footballers, or in your case, breakers, you know. And I know a lot of people have a passion for it. It's just about facilities. And are you looking at spaces to be able to do this then?
Yeah, I've been in contact with a few places. I only put the post on yesterday and I've had people messaging me wanting to get it done. There's been the mention of a breaking event happening at the recreation ground as well. So people are interested in it straight away. So there's definitely a market for it, and I will be pursuing it.
Absolutely. And I'm sure it said something about, was it a community interest kind of thing? Or
so all of that sort of stuff is not for profit.
Yeah.
It actually winds me up now that people profit off of that, especially being so involved in business. I'm like, I think things like that should stay organic.
Well, it's good. Well, there's another argument as well for, you know, like kids that don't have a lot, you know, who don't have a lot of money but want to pursue passions. That's what makes me think, you know, why do they make it so, you know, expensive, or why do they even charge at times? I mean, I get it if you're, for example, some football clubs will charge you £20 a month to play there. You've got all the facilities, you're helping, keeping everything restored, you're paying for all the staff that they might need, or whatever. I get that. But you know, when there's places where it's like, do you really need to charge for something like that? There's just kids that just want to have fun here. Why can't you just, you know, if the building's empty, you don't need to rent it out for an hour. You know, just let people enjoy it. And, you know, and I think that's important. I think sometimes, as you say, you know, business money, fair enough, but, you know, and it's passion and it's leisure, it should be about people having fun.
Yeah, it should be 100% accessible for anyone that wants to do it, especially in the society that we're living in at the moment where people can't afford electricity. Why should children have to be paying to come to a breakdance lesson?
So how, and I'm going to ask a very relevant question then in that respect. Obviously, you mentioned the energy crisis. I try not to go off on tangents about it because I think we all know who's at fault. It is the last few generations of governments that have ignored the fact that the Russia invading Ukraine is a real possibility and that will cause an energy crisis. It's the fact that we have allowed private enterprises to take our energy and sell it on for ridiculous prices and put people into poverty. We've allowed that to happen. So I want to know, what impact is that having on your business? Is it having a major impact on your business, or are you not feeling anything much?
Well, that's how I sort of tailored my business. So if you come to my kiosk, you find that most things are under £20. And I call it an impulse buy. So what that means is that they can look at the rings, they can look at necklaces, things like that. And you think, you know what, it's £15, I can afford that.
Mm.
So it makes it accessible in that sense. So I would say it hasn't impacted me at all at the moment.
At the moment, yeah. But I think, I mean, obviously I can see from, you know, the pub here, it seems to be okay. You know, a lot of other restaurants and stuff are still doing okay. A lot of the target markets of businesses can, you know, they can still afford many of these things. Obviously, the energy crisis and the cost of living really is hitting the people at perhaps the lower income of society, the people that are on the lowest incomes, and those people need to be helped, because we shouldn't just help people that are on lower incomes to the point where they can just afford energy and fuel and food. We should help them to the point where they can afford that and still be able to have something for them and their kids. You know what I mean?
I'll be slightly controversial.
Go on.
And what I would say is the way out of this crisis is not giving them more money, because that isn't going to resolve the issue. The way to get them out of the problem is to help them budget, is to help them understand where they're spending the money, where they shouldn't be spending it, spending money on takeaways, spending money on rings at my shop. I know that I'm strangling my own business.
Yeah, no.
But it's making sure that people understand budgeting. When I was at school, I was never taught about budgeting.
Mm.
These are the things that the young generation have not been given. So they're going through life and they're not understanding that if they don't budget, they're going to end up in crisis.
Mm.
I've done it.
Yeah. but it's true. No, you're true. The only reason we got taught, would you believe it, 20 minutes worth of budgeting lesson at all from our whole time at secondary school and primary school was because of COVID. That was the only reason. They've never taught it since. And I came across an interesting, and obviously this is way easier said than done. I'm in a position where I'm 16. I don't pay tax. I don't earn enough in terms of what is in my bank account to say that I need to pay tax. So I can't, right? And therefore, I saw a video, and it was Shaquille O'Neal, and obviously he's multi-millionaire, whatever, and he set up his own shoe business that was for lower income kids, shoes that are $20, $30 or whatever, much cheaper than that of Jordans that are $150, $200 that are, you know, parents are saving up for months to pay for. And he said, save 75, spend 75, and even when you spend that 75, spend it wisely. And for me, that made me feel a certain way. And since then, I've literally followed that principle whenever I get paid from work. I save 75% and I might spend that 25, maybe. Mm-hmm. And that just goes to things that I need. Tram, lunch for school. That's it. And for me, I've been happy and I've saved so much money, you know. Is there any tips that, for example, there might be someone listening now that maybe is thinking, how am I going to save money? Can you give them any advice on that?
It's just taking control. I think ignorance is bliss.
Mm.
So a lot of people don't check what they're spending and they don't check what their bills are and they don't add them all up because ignorance is bliss.
Mm.
So for us as a family, we don't have much money. My partner's on maternity leave. I'm only on a basic salary because my business hasn't grown enough to pay me what I want to be paid yet. So we're feeling it just as much as anyone else. But what we do is we put our bills on the fridge. All written down to remind us, and it needs to become like something that you look at and that you understand and that you think, right, I shouldn't really spend that 40 quid on that because that's going to eat into my food budget. And it's just living that way. I know it's not a good way to live always, but at this moment in time it's the way that everyone should
you
be thinking
to. Yeah, and you know unfortunately, as you said, I think people are making sacrifices that they don't want to have to make. Nobody wants to have to tell their kids, no, you can't have that thing. Although I think most parents do tell their kids that anyway. But you know, everybody wants to treat the kids, the family, and they want to do that. But it's hard to do that when stuff like this is happening. And I can't say that I understand what is fully going on because I don't pay tax. I don't have a family. I don't have my own house. So for me to be able to say, oh, I understand how difficult it is, would be completely ridiculous. I don't, you know. And that's why I kind of want to know what it's like for you and, you know.
You sort of touched on it earlier about the Jordans and buying the cheaper option. A lot of people go and buy things new, which we could go into a massive tangent, but it affects the environment, it affects
absolutely
many things. But as an example, we went to something called the mum-to-mum market that happens in Beeston.
Mm.
And you buy all of the clothes for your children and toys and stuff secondhand. So then what that means is that you're spending less for... I'll give you an example. We bought a Mamas and Papas kids bouncer.
Yeah.
Would have been 80 quid. We paid 15 quid for it.
Wow.
So the point is something like that you would go and buy for £80 when you can buy it for 15.
Mm.
And it's just swallowing your pride and saying, you know what, let's buy it secondhand.
And there's nothing wrong with buying it secondhand. Unless it's got some massive hole in it and it's absolutely it's mouldy, there is nothing wrong with it.
No.
You know, this is something that we have a problem with in the West.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say the West.
Yeah.
I think if you go to the Eastern side of the world, bar Australia and New Zealand or other countries, you will see that countries that are technically lower income countries do not have the issue of buying things firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
They will buy things that aren't branded. They will make things and they will buy secondhand things and even things that we don't want anymore. And for me, I think we need to look at society and go, okay, we're all obsessed with buying things brand new. What's wrong with buying things secondhand? Because I don't see the issue. You know, if someone had said to me, you can have a microphone off me for 50 quid, same microphone, I would have had it.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? As long as it's working correctly, I've got no problem with it. So it's a consumer issue.
It
would
is.
You agree?
Yeah, it's definitely a consumer issue. As an example for me, people's experiences are different. So when I was younger, my mum used to go to the charity shops and buy me clothes. And I used to get called Tesco Two Stripe and used to get the mick taken out of me. So I wouldn't have ever dreamed of buying things secondhand.
Mm.
But it's just breaking that cycle in your mind that it's old, it's used, it's cheap. It's not. It's just repurposing something and using it for its original purpose.
Mm. And it's wrong that people get, and people still get bullied now for it, you know. And I can remember coming in a pair of Reebok shoes. They weren't, you know, there was nothing wrong with them. But people would still take the mick out of you because it's not Nike, it's not Adidas, it's not Puma, it's not Gucci, it's not Jordans, it's not... And you think, why does it matter? You know, if I took the logo off these shoes and you would then say something. So really you're only looking at one part of a shoe. You're not looking at the shoe, what it's going to do for you, what purpose does it serve. You are looking at the symbol that's on it and that is it.
And that comes down to, again, consumers, marketing... the way that they promote them online.
You buy brands, don't you? You don't mm-hmm. buy clothes, you buy brands.
That's right, yeah.
So what do you think, for example, because I think this is something that you can't tell people what to buy and what not to buy. You can persuade them, but this is a real issue that's not just causing an issue for example, people being bullied and stuff like that. Massive problem, because it happens in adults too. But it's also a case of how do we... You know, for the planet's sake, how do we encourage people to go secondhand and maybe actually think about your spending habits a bit?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there has been a shift. I think if I was to have spoke to you 20 years ago, you'd have been in the same mindset that I was in, that you don't want to have that, it's secondhand. I want to get the mick taken out of me.
Mm.
I feel like there's this new culture of young people coming through, particularly where my shop is, where they're buying secondhand clothes. And you have these companies like Depop, and big emphasis on Etsy and eBay, all promoting. Have you seen that advert where the kid has the doll at the end on the eBay advert? It's powerful. And people need to learn that you can actually get the things that you want secondhand.
Mm.
And brands are dying now.
And they are. And I think the way, if brands want to become a sustainable business, they should realise that, okay, if you're done with your product, don't chuck it in the bin. Send it back to us, we'll give you money, or we can repurpose it, or there's got to be something that you can do, because even if I broke my jumper, I could cut it into bits and make it into something cool.
Mm-hmm.
You can recycle clothing, and we should, you know, and obviously it's difficult, whatever, but I think companies should invest in things that will recycle clothing or help people to put it somewhere else other than just in the bin, because there is other places it can go and help other people, you know, in the future. And obviously the market that you mentioned, It's incredible, because I know that for a fact that when my sister became a mom, it was difficult because of how much stuff it costed for mm-hmm. some of the things. But these are things that you have to have for a kid.
Exactly, yeah.
So you can't make that compromise of how much it costs. You've just got to go, this is how much it costs, unless there is markets like that around, you know.
And us as consumers, our job would be to share these things that we see in the community, get behind them, and only us cumulatively can change the habits of everyone else. Because people, what do I call it? They call it the Jones effect. Mm. So it's a basic sales technique. So if your next door neighbour has a brand new car, you think, oh, I want a new car. Mm. They've got a new driveway. Should we have a driveway done, Deborah?
Yeah.
But
yeah.
That's the idea is behind it, is that, call it keeping up with the Joneses. So if a group of people make change, then we can inspire more change. Mm. But that happens through individuals first.
Of course. So it's going to take a group of people perhaps to kind of start a revolution in regards to how consumers pay, what they pay for, and the things that they pay for, what happens when they're done with them. So I want to talk obviously a little bit about your business now as well, and kind of get a bit deeper into that. So obviously you've been, how long has it been an actual shop for now?
1 month and a half.
Wow. So so far, how are you feeling? Obviously your own place. I mean, I know as soon as I walked in this studio room for the first time and I was like, this is my place. And then over time you got the tables in, you got your whatever up and you got new stuff and you think, wow, this is my place. How does that make you feel? You proud?
Yes, definitely. I think me personally, again, because of my own default behaviours, I need things to show that I've been successful, which sometimes can be a thorn in my side, but I need that shop shows that I've got something of value. The online shop that I built before, it's just words. It doesn't have, there's no physical thing for anyone to see, is there? So that's why I like having my shop so much.
Mm. And obviously it does serve a purpose anyway when it comes to business, because obviously you're right in the city centre. May I ask where you're based exactly?
So it's Hopkinson's Vintage Centre.
Okay.
Which is just next to the train station, down from Tesco.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Wow. So I'm trying to think, is it the one that's having there's something being built next to it?
Yes, yeah, there's some student accommodation being built next to it.
Yeah, because my friend used to have a shop there, and he used to do up like cabinets and stuff, and he'd like upholster them almost, and he'd do a lot of painting for them. Amazing stuff, and I'm sure he used to be in that building, I'm sure. But yeah, so you're in a great location, right next to the train station. What gave you the idea of going there?
I think I mentioned it before, so I was a manager there before.
Oh, I see, sorry. Yeah,
and basically people were leaving, and I thought, you know what, there's a unique window for me to get in there.
I see, yeah, sorry. So obviously it's a good location, and would you say first month and a half, good month and a half?
Yeah, best sellers have been all the low-end rings, everyone's loving the rings, and Amigas. So the vintage men's Amigas, I can't get them in quick enough.
Really? So what are they? I don't know if I feel silly.
So Amiga is a luxury Swiss brand. They've been around for a long time, and vintage means that it's approximately, some people are stopped to say it has to be 100 years, but anything past the 80s, I'd say, is vintage nowadays. Wow. So anything past the 80s, Amiga, men are coming in and they're buying them, because if you was to buy that from a place like Cope's in Nottingham, you're paying £3,000. I'm selling it at 800.
Wow. So I don't even get how you manage to do that. Obviously, I won't get you to reveal your secrets of how you manage to do that, but that it must be difficult, because you must have to search for them, mm-hmm. right, to get that.
Yeah, definitely. And we have to put a lot of work in, and we have to complete places like Cope's or other places, they want to buy them, like, ready to sell, and they don't particularly do anything to them. That's my assumption anyway. And we're completely buying them, completely scrap almost, and completely reviving them. So,
wow! So you're giving them a completely new lease of life then, and mm-hmm. and completely almost not changing the way it is, because obviously you're going to restore it to what it originally was.
Exactly, yeah.
But just give it that bit of a polish as well.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it looks exactly how it would have looked, but we bring it completely back to life.
Wow.
So as I said, because those bottom feeders, we get the stuff that no one else wants.
But then you make it better.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know the old adage, don't you? You know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
Exactly.
And I suppose people, but this is what people don't realise. The things that people chuck on the floor and the things that people don't want, or people don't want anymore, or should I say what social media portrays people don't want anymore, there is still a huge market for,
mm-hmm.
in reality.
Yeah.
You know, so tell me more about these Amiga watches. Like, what do you know about them? Like, tell me more about them. I'm interested. So the older watches. So
they're all old mechanical watches. Mm. So if you think about a car's engine,
mm-hmm.
Think of it the same. So it's built up of lots of little components to make it work.
Mm.
There was big. It was big in Swiss. Everyone had a Swiss watch back in them days. If it weren't Swiss, it weren't Adidas, as you said earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's pretty much what they are. They were just a luxury brand in that time, and probably one of the leading ones in the market.
Wow. So it's a big name brand. People love it, and getting hold of them difficult. So that adds to the value. And also, because you do work on it yourself, it also adds that idea of authenticity to it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So is that maybe perhaps why you think you pride your shop over others? Because there is that level of authenticity and you've actually dealt with that watch. You've got a story with that watch.
People buy from people. Yes. I'm going into sales again, but that's what people buy. They don't actually buy the product very much.
Mm.
They buy the brand, like you've already said, or they buy from the person.
Mm.
If I was to walk up to you and talk to you, you would decide whether you like me straight away or not from the first initial interaction that we have. And that's the way sales works.
Mm.
So it works the same in the shop. People buy from people. I'm a bit flamboyant.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a burgundy shirt.
Mm.
but people like to talk to me and have a conversation with me, and that's why they buy, not because of the brand.
Yeah, because I know if I walked into a shop and I saw there was a watch for £5, let's say there was some super mega deal and it was like 99.999% off, and I'm like, oh my god, this is the greatest day of my life, I've got £5 exactly, and I walk in there and there's someone really horrible at the desk and they're nasty to me, they're unaccommodating, they're not warm, you think, I think I'd rather go to the shop next to it that's charging £20 because they're actually going to be nice to me. And yeah. I don't quite trust them that is a nice watch in reality when I put it on.
And by association, whenever you wear that watch, you're going to think of that initial interaction that you had.
And then you think, I wonder what another interaction would be like. I wonder if you can have two watches on one arm, you know, and that kind of thing. So I'm going to ask you a question. I don't know a lot about watches. I've got a Samsung, I don't know, like third or whatever generation, like electric kind of watch. It's just for, I have a stopwatch on it, can do running, sprinting, walking, whatever, measures all my steps, and kind of does what my phone can't when I don't have it. So what is your favourite kind of watch? Is it the Amiga, or is there any kind of watch that's your favourite, or brand of watch that's your favourite?
I like the weird stuff. I like the stuff that, so there was something called the Quartz Crisis.
Hmm.
So just before the Quartz Crisis in the like 80s, 70s, they were just banging out the most random watches, and you get the most random names that you've never heard of before, not a brand name.
Mm.
And I love the stuff like that, the stuff yeah. that I sell for 30, 40 quid. But I just love the way that they are and the story behind them and the fact that they're the neglected watch that no one wanted.
So you like the idea of Quartz Crisis watches then, essentially, and that kind of period of time when it was just loads of wacky different things and...
Yeah, and then the Quartz watch was invented, and then all of these watch brands just died.
And that was it?
Yeah, so all of these things, they're like social history almost.
Wow, so really it's like when someone buys a classic car that they don't produce anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You think, okay, let's say that I've just brought a brand new Ferrari. I say brand new, this is 40 years old. They don't make these anymore. There is 100 in the world. That kind of thing, because obviously there's going to be a limited amount of those watches.
Yeah.
how on earth do you find them? Obviously, if you don't want to answer that question, I completely understand, but how on earth do you find those watches?
Well, there is no particular answer.
Okay.
It's meticulous trawling of the internet, visiting places. There's no one way that we're able to get them. So
there is it's no just however you can get them, you will get them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when so let's say I walk into your shop and I say to you, I've got a photo of a watch that I want. Now, it's nothing, you know, rose gold straight from Dubai. I want you to go and steal off this king and whatever, you know. It is, I don't know, a £60 watch. It's from the 60s. And I want this. Would you do something where you try and find that watch? Or are you just based on what I've got in the shop now is what I'm selling?
Generally, what I've got is what I've got.
Yeah.
Because it's so hard to source. We do repair other people's stuff as well. So.
Hmm. Oh, so you do repairs as well in shop as well? Okay.
So, for instance, I had a lady in yesterday and she had like a 1920s watch that was her grandma's. And she just wanted it to work just for sentimental reasons. She didn't actually want to wear it.
Hmm.
So we just kicked it back into working order.
Wow.
So, and nowhere's doing that anymore.
No, because it's quite intricate, isn't it? You know, I'm guessing you've got that really small screwdriver. That's all I think of when I think of what makes like that really tiny one. You've got the little eye thing on, you're trying to kind of get that out. What is it like fixing a watch? Are you not? I'd be trembling all the time, you know.
Well, I don't do it.
Oh, I see.
So my brother does that now.
Wow.
So I used to do it, but he's the one that does it now. But it's you've got to have the patience of a saint.
I already know I'm not going to do it now.
Yeah. And I don't have the patience of a saint, so that's why I don't do it anymore.
Hmm. So what? So are you more like business side and your brother is like doing the fixing the watches side? Are you selling the watches and he's doing the jewellery and the watches fixing it? Or you do a bit of, he does a bit of both?
There's a big team of us, to be honest. But he looks after the fixing of the watches and the listing of watches. So
So have you got other staff that work for you then, I assume, like doing it? Or
I've got different people that do different things outsourced. Mm. A lot of them don't actually work for me, they're freelance, but I pay them to do certain things, etc.
Wow.
Websites, development.
I see, that's awesome. So we've touched on a lot, and I think we've got to know you quite a bit. And but before I even think about saying whatever, you know, in the end and stuff, I want to get to know your thoughts on cars. Are you interested in cars?
I don't drive.
You don't drive? No. Okay. Well, because this is something we spoke about. You know Austin Blakemore? I spoke to him about cars and he was telling me about electric cars and all that. And I don't know if you're interested in technology or and stuff like that. Do you have an interest in like EV kind of technology?
I'm afraid not. If it's not mechanical and it's not old.
Mechanical. Okay. In fact, no. If it is old then, what do you think? I don't know if... I'm trying to think of questions now even to ask you about mechanical kind of things like old trains, old cars. Because there's got to be... Obviously, I know you're not interested in cars, perhaps, but old classic cars? Is there anything that interests you in that?
Definitely. I've already got my eye on that. I think I've told you, I follow the money and I follow the opportunity.
And classic cars have got it there.
And classic cars is a commodity. I'm only interested if it's a commodity.
Okay.
Do you understand what I mean by
that? Yeah. So what? So you think maybe classic cars is something you might go into in the future?
More than definitely.
Wow.
Because it's if you buy a Jaguar, as an example, for 100 grand and it's worth 100 grand, it's only going to go up in value if you maintain its condition.
Mm.
It's a commodity now. We're in this new era where we have new modern commodities that we didn't have before. Again, vintage watches. They're now a commodity. You buy it at £60, you know it's going to be worth more in 10 years.
Houses
is a commodity. I'll be in that for sure.
Wow. So it's watches first, and then you're going to keep that. I assume you're going to keep that running.
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to tell the people that are listening. To be honest, it's quite easy. I've done it before. I had a watch business before, and I folded it to another business, and then that business failed. And that was through my own doing.
Hmm.
But what you should do is you should do something called a lifeline business. So a lifeline business is something that you continue forever. And
if everything goes wrong, it's there.
It's always there.
I get that.
Build your foundations first. So that's why I'm talking about in the future I'll do that, because I'll do my watch business before. I'll make sure that it runs itself and I replace myself, and then I'll do the next thing and do the next thing.
And you can run it executively almost.
Mm-hmm.
So classic cars, interesting. It's a very good business. Hard to get into in regards to finance, because it's some of these cars you're seeing out there, they cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, unless you're like fixing them up and restoring them in that way, it'll cost a bit less, I can imagine, but still a lot. Is there any classic cars that you would say you're particularly interested in?
Breitling watches came from, I can't remember the exact car. It's gone out of my brain.
I'm trying to think now, because I'm sure I know this one actually, because I know Breitling watches. I'm trying to think.
I can't remember the name. It's gone out of my brain. But they made watches for, was it? No, it weren't Aston Martin, was it? Who was it?
What, Bentley, was it? Or
Bentley. Bentley. There we go. We're back.
I thought so. Okay.
So I like the idea of having a Bentley because it links to Breitling.
Mm. So Bentleys, classic Bentleys. Modern Bentleys, I think they're good, but I like the older ones more.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I like the idea of this big black car, you know, you're in a suit and you can it's just very leisurely and it's just very relaxed, old fashioned. I like it. It's just very smart. So classic cars, real estate, watches. Have you thought about anything on the cloud in terms of like stock markets and Bitcoin or anything like that? Or is that not something you're interested in?
People would argue with me, but I think Bitcoin, all of these other things are subjective in value.
Mm.
And they're not a commodity. The stock market is not a commodity. That's been proved by the recession.
Yeah.
By the crumbling of different places. You put your money in that and you put your money in the Russian stock market and Russia goes to war with Ukraine, what's going to happen to your money?
Going to lose all of it.
You're going to lose all of it. So it's not a commodity because it can be
lost,
affected by outside factors.
Yeah.
The house, you buy a house, it's going to always maintain its value, whether there's a war, whether there's... If you're Russian and you buy your house is still going to be worth the same amount of people to the same amount of money to the people in Russia.
Mm. And the only way it wouldn't be is if there was a disaster. That
exactly.
There's, for example, there's houses in Cornwall that used to be 100,000 to 70,000. They're now a pound. Because there is a point where you can only live there for a few months before this house potentially falls off this little miniature cliff into the sea.
Yeah.
Erosion. They're really the only times that housing would be worth less and gradually gets less if there is a danger or if you know that house is probably going to fuck up and that's it. So, yeah, I think, and also with...
As an example, so Elon Musk did a tweet about that he was going to take over Twitter. He went from worth being 50 points to 70 points. People invested in that period and then it shrunk back. And then people that invested lost their money. And it's people like Elon Musk that have the power to manipulate the markets that are always going to win.
Hmm. It's almost you've got that much money that... I think that he could be the first trillionaire.
Mm-hmm.
100%. Yeah. My only issue with stock markets, and it's something that a friend of mine told me, and he said, it's all great buying Bitcoin in 2012 and now having £1 million or £2 million. But there's the big problem of it doesn't have any assets. It is completely in the air. Like there's no physical Bitcoin. It's a machine. Whereas stock markets, at least, or you know, kind of hard stocks, at least they have physical value. Do you know what I mean? They have physical assets. Whereas Bitcoin doesn't have that at all.
You're buying into an idea.
You're buying in to make someone else money as well.
Yeah.
Someone's profiting from it. Someone does. I mean, there's one guy that owns like 50% of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
So whoever that guy is, I don't even think there's enough money in the banks to take it out for him.
Yeah, but the thing is if the bank, a lot of countries have clamped down on it and said, we're not accepting that as a currency in this country, it's illegal. And then when that happens, it goes underground and it loses its value.
Hmm. So do you think that would be a good thing to do if they were to say, we shouldn't allow this currency anymore?
I don't know the answer.
It's a hard one, isn't it? It's a hard question.
For instance, if you go on to drugs, the problem is, for instance, cannabis weed is illegal. So then it creates this market, illegal market. It'd be better if it was legal, because then they could tax it, they could make money from it.
It'd
be safer. So if Bitcoin was made legal, it was accepted by banks, therefore they could moderate it, make people safe. It works in the same concept.
So a lot of things that are illegal are actually huge business opportunities for the people that have actually made them illegal. Really, the government could say, well, we've got a crisis at the moment with this, this and this. We need to fund this. Oh, okay. But if you introduce cannabis as a recreational drug, you could actually tax this and you will have money to fund that thing.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
You're going to have less people being imprisoned, which is going to save you money on the prison system.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you want that? Why wouldn't you want that? You know, exactly. You're telling me that there's going to be less people in prison. I mean, don't forget that the rapists and paedophiles get less prison sentence than drug dealers and things like that. So the system for that is fundamentally broken anyway.
Yeah.
But I think that if we can say, look, people want to have cannabis, okay, there's an underground market, people are being laced, there's cannabis laced with heroin and other drugs, people are dying. But if we did it safely and the government regulated it and there was genuine specialists dealing with cannabis to sell to people, actually there's not only a business opportunity but an opportunity to keep people safe.
Exactly.
So.
And it works the same with Bitcoin, in the sense that if the bank said Bitcoin is a real currency and we accept it, yeah, there'd be an initial amount of money that they'd have to outlet, but then that money would be reinvested into the economy and not be used, given on a little fire stick to someone, and it not taxed.
Mm. And then somebody potentially losing their life savings, getting hacked, and losing things. And then, in reality, I mean, a lot of people that, you know, if we were to say people don't need to go to rehabilitation to stop using cannabis or anything, and if you made it legal and you maybe, I don't know, you made it so that the cannabis wasn't as addictive or it wasn't laced with things that make people ill or whatever, which is very rare but happens, then perhaps that's the right thing to do. I don't know, obviously I'm not nowhere near in government, but I think we are allowed that opinion. And in my opinion, less people in the prison system, less people selling drugs and less people in gangs selling it and stabbing each other, less people being laced with other drugs that might be inside it because of people trying to kill each other or whatever, and more money in, from tax, I say yes.
Yeah.
I say yes, all the way. So, but yeah, I think we've talked about a lot in today's podcast. I think we've talked about a lot.
Yeah.
And I'm interested. So obviously, you know, we got a glimpse of your story from a harsh upbringing, a tragic upbringing, to making something of yourself. And I think obviously you should be very proud. I'm glad that we've had this conversation, because it's nice to have a chat with someone that is genuinely inspiring, and that has inspired me. And I'm sure that it'll inspire other people, because maybe there is people that have had either a similar upbringing or going through something now, younger and older people, and maybe they want to change their life. And of course that isn't easy, but there is a way to do it, and I think you've shown that. So massive respects to you for coming and telling your story. I know it's not easy to tell your story, but you've done it, and I have all faith that everything's going to go good for you, and I'll surely be buying a watch very soon.
Okay.
So that was Ash Hudson, everybody. So thank you very much for coming on. That was episode 77, and it's been an absolute pleasure to share the studio with you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Did you enjoy that episode of the Batwall podcast? Well, if so, share, follow, like, do what you need to do. We would really, really appreciate it. Do tune into the next episode. If you're listening on Thursday, the next episode's on Sunday. And if you're listening on Sunday, the next episode's on Thursday. But any day that you are listening, take a listen to all of our more than 50 episodes available, and do share them and let us know what you think. Thank you for listening.